Good afternoon, and welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Neil Denny. Every fortnight, we hope to ease you into the weekend with some stimulating conversation on a talk show which does have an agenda. It's an agenda which is atheist, rationalist, humanist, and for the progressive left. We'll be spending the next hour in the company of the journalist, critic, and TV presenter, Jonathan Meads, and I'm going to hand over to Neil to introduce him.
Thanks, Richard. Jonathan Meads is a writer on architecture, culture, and food. He has written novels, including Pompey and the Fowler Family Business, and a collection of food writing, Incest and Morris Dancing. He is probably best known for his television work. His series, Abroad in Britain, is now in its fourth series. Speaking of his television work, James Dellingpole of The Spectator described Jonathan as loush, sinister, and possibly certifiable. Meads may well be the most exciting thing to happen to television since Kenneth Tynan said fuck. Of course, this statement was written before Celebrity Love Island was broadcast. Jonathan, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms.
Thanks, great to be here on Celebrity Love Island.
We should, of course, mention your own foray into the celebrity world, although at the good end, Jonathan was the recent winner of Celebrity Mastermind. Well, I was reading the BBC website and looking at some of the viewers' comments on the last series of Abroad in Britain, and particularly the comments on the Salisbury Cathedral episode. And there was, you know, there was sort of criticism you could expect from Christians, basically saying that, erroneously I thought, that the programme was an excuse to attack Christianity. One of the letters stuck out to me. It was quite an old canard that the Christians have been saying for a long time, and, you know, for years. And, you know, I apologise to Margaret Summers of Derby for reading a letter out on Resonance FM, but anyway, it went, "I had looked forward to the programme about Salisbury Cathedral, but I was horrified to find that it was just a vehicle for Jonathan Meads to criticise belief in God and religion. I suggested if he wants to do so, he should try and use the architecture of a different religion, where people may not take it so good-naturedly when he calls their beliefs into question." Now, I was thinking about this, and you know, a while ago I would have sort of dismissed it, but in the current climate, it actually struck me as being quite sort of relevant. And a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed the journalist Nick Cohen. And he'd recently written about the latest exhibition by Gilbert and George, Son of a God Pictures, Was Jesus a Heterosexual? And he was basically envisaging that the avant-garde was dead, really, and that we live in an age where an artist can attack the royal family, the church, the government, without sort of question, and nobody's bothered. But they wouldn't dare actually transgress in a way that an artist should by attacking something. Islam, for instance, is the obvious example.
I certainly would if I could get away with it.
Well, that's the point. You can't get away with it.
I can't get it. No, it's not a question of self-censorship on my part. In one of the programmes in that series, there was a gag about a woman in a burqa, and I found this changed to a gag about a nun. I hold no brief for nuns whatsoever, but I mean, I did think it was insulting to nuns in a way that it was different. It's qualitatively different because it is only women who've taken orders in Christianity who wear this ridiculous garb. Whereas lots of Muslims do. I'm completely with the French government on this about,
sure,
about La Foulard. I mean, I think it's preposterous.
So that was changed, was it?
It was changed.
Okay.
It was changed, yes. I mean, and it's not the first time that things have been changed. In my novel, The Fowler Family Business, which was finished in the summer of 2001, there was a gag which I actually got from an elderly Jewish lady who said, "What do you call an Arab with a suitcase? A terrorist. What do you call an Arab without a suitcase? A terrorist on the cheap." And I used this in that book, and my editor at Fourth Estate, just after 9/11, said, you can't say this. And I said, of course you can say it. What are you doing? Kind of giving in to, you know, these maniacs who use planes as guided missiles. And the tenderness with which they have been treated subsequently. And so it was left in, and Nick Pearson, my editor, subsequently said, yes, he's very glad he had left it in, given that, you know, the way in which everyone has got incredibly sensitive about offending religions other than Christianity and Judaism, of course.
Well,
it seems to be, you know, if you're the mayor of London, you seem to be able to say what you like to Jews, and while at the same time, you know, inviting homophobic maniacs who want to kill us all to come and lecture because they're scholars.
Well, it's quite interesting that you raise that sort of bit of censorship then, because actually a few of the criticisms on the BBC's website mentioned the joke about a number of nuns being tucked in the, you know, in the cathedral or something, and that was just...
Oh, that was a different one. There was
and
there are lots of nun things in that.
Fair enough.
But I don't think that was just a kind of a throwaway. But I mean, the point in general that Margaret Summers of Derby makes, I think, it's an entirely valid one. I agree with her.
Absolutely, but it's true that in today's climate, you're not in a position to do that. So the idea that, you know, we've been debating the concept of freedom of speech and it's clearly not really a level playing field, is it?
No, there most certainly isn't freedom of speech. I mean, it's you know, there are various reasons. I mean, British newspapers didn't not publish the Danish cartoons for any reason other than they didn't want to get firebombed.
Sure.
I mean, we all know this. It hasn't been particularly... it hasn't been stated much. I mean, they all, you know, they've done what is the usual thing and, you know, made a moral case for not publishing them, which is pusillanimous and mendacious, I think.
Certainly.
You actually, you're on record, I think, as describing England as the most censorious country in the Western world at the moment.
I think it is. It's certainly far more censorious than France, Spain, the former Catholic countries. The former Catholic countries are less... they're less worried about religion. They're probably more, and also about sexuality. They're more kind of confident. There's a kind of, you know, I know we are a basically secular society, but we're a post-Protestant secular society rather than the post-Catholic one. And I think there is a difference.
But the religion is still important in France, Spain and Italy, the countries you mentioned. There are a lot. The religiosity there is far higher than it is in the UK.
No, it's not in France.
No?
No. The instance of people who are deluded enough to go to church in France is actually smaller than it is in England. It's got, in some ways, a more religious population because it's got a far larger Muslim population.
Sure.
And, you know, Muslims tend to be devout. I mean, of Christian denominations, the successful ones in this country are anything but the Church of England, which is, you know, the established thing. I mean, it's either happy clappies at one end of it or Roman Catholics. I mean, there are churches in Coventry which get 2,000 people. I mean, Roman Catholic churches which get 2,000 people turning up. It's extraordinary. I mean, these vast barns built after the war, and they're full.
I'm curious about the, you know, this idea of England being the most censorious country. I mean, because it's a peculiar kind of censoriousness, isn't it? It's not so much a political thing and trying to stop people criticising people in power, so much as a kind of desperate avoidance of offending anybody.
Well, there's that, and there is prurience, which is a facet of Puritanism or Protestantism, I think. The fact that, you know, the newspapers in this country are far sort of dirtier and grubbier than
they are
elsewhere. But at the same time, you don't see hardcore pornography on terrestrial telly. Mm-hmm.
I think I once read somebody saying, I think it was about the Daily Mail, that it was, you know, it's it seems to be perpetually worried that somewhere somebody's having fun.
Yes, I suppose. I guess so, but I don't think it's just the Daily Mail. I think there has been a kind of Daily Mailization of all of the press, partly because the rest of the press recognises that that is what is commercially successful.
And yet at the same time, those are the papers that would rail against what they would call political correctness.
Yeah, absolutely. But sorry, what did you say in your last question? You said there was an unwillingness to offend.
To offend, yes.
Well, again, it comes down to offend who? I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are constantly offended by that very quality of unwillingness to offend and of the way in which emotions are either, you know, heart on sleeve, you know, Diana dies and all of that sort of stuff.
There's a kind of emotional correctness there.
Yeah. Or there is the sort of bottled upness and avoidance and sort of occluded emotionalism, which comes out in all sorts of really peculiar ways. But I think one thing, looking at it from the perspective of London, is that London has so seceded from the rest of Britain that, I mean, because I have, you know, sort of over the last 15 years made something like 50 films in different parts of Britain, I spent an awful lot of time in provincial Britain, and it is much more like a foreign country to me than Paris or Brussels are like foreign cities. That there is a huge difference, and I think that it may be changing very, very slowly, but it's not just a difference of how places look and how people talk and so on. There is in mentation, and I think there is a considerable difference.
Well, you mentioned about the sort of prurience of the press and obviously of television. We've already mentioned Celebrity Love Island, not that I want to give it any more publicity. And in this, we were talking about this article that we'd found earlier, and in the first line of it you say, I did a television programme called Everyman, and because it appeals to people who can read and write, it is buried in the schedule sometime around about midnight. So what's it like to be trying to produce, you know, interesting, erudite television programmes in a culture of sort of prurience as a filmmaker?
Well, I don't think the culture of prurience actually has much effect on it. It doesn't actually at the moment, but under certain television regimes. I mean, as I say, I don't think this applies at the moment to BBC, which is where I have done the vast majority of my work. There has been this idea that populism is popular, mm-hmm. and populism isn't particularly popular. Especially not in an age where there is such an extraordinary amount of choice. And my last series got about an average of 2.5 million viewers. Match the Day only gets 3. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kind of stuff I do is, you know, taxi drivers and people and bobbies and doctors and all sorts of people tell me, you know, they've watched such and such a program. It sort of goes, people are very interested in topography, the built environment, and the kind of subjects I address. It's not a recondite subject. However, the kind of people who run news media and newspapers, especially newspapers, don't get it because it is not part of their their milieu. I mean, it's that they think about sport, they think about politics, they think about crime, and that's about it. It's not really the arts. It's not pop music. It's not, and so on. I mean, so, the stuff is well received and gets good audience, but the broadcasting executives and newspaper executives are not necessarily particularly bright people.
Well, the programmes on architecture on BBC Two are sort of hagiographies about there'll be a programme about Buckingham Palace or something with somebody walking around respectfully hushed saying, oh, look at this. And your style is obviously completely different to that. So do you think that's the reason why it's so popular?
Maybe. My programmes are not all necessarily denigratory. I mean, there are certain buildings that I've filmed which I'm very fond of.
Like, but they're irreverent.
They're just set out to be reasonably truthful to myself. Sure. I set out not to please. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's also an important thing, I think. I think trying to be accessible is the most stupidly relativist thing you can possibly do, because it's one of those words like affordable. I mean, a Rolls Royce is very affordable if you've just pulled off a heist in Tunbridge.
Sure.
But it's not affordable if you're a social worker in SCEM.
Mm-hmm.
And accessible is the same. I mean, what is accessible to, I don't know, Jonathan Miller is not accessible to someone who's got an IQ in single figures.
Sure.
And accessible has come to mean it's all got to be for very, very stupid people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the presumption that no one really wants to tax their brain. This is an assumption, again, in newspapers and television. And it's completely... the wrongness of that is shown by the kind of books that sells. I mean, if you read Julian Barnes or David Mitchell, your brain is working, and they're selling lots and lots of copies. And they're selling lots and lots of copies to some extent because, during, say, the 60s and 70s, books didn't sell terribly well. But at that point, you had extremely high quality television. You had Peter Nichols, you had James Cameron, you had Dennis Potter, you had David Halliwell, and so on. And people have gone back to I don't think people are particularly preoccupied by what medium it is. They want either quality or trash. I mean, you can get trash books. I mean, Dan Brown,
indeed.
J.K. Rowling. I mean, you can get
those books. Obviously, sell massively as well.
They sell massively, but you can. But quality does sell. There are enough people. There's a large enough constituency in this country to support quality productions in whatever medium it happens to be.
Well, indeed, I think that's true. I mean, this station is actually one that, is aiming towards the artistically literate and
well, that's why I'm here on Celebrity Love Island.
That's right. So I think that's possibly evidence of that, although we don't really move into sort of BBC listenership figures.
Well, there has been an idea coming for years that the old sort of patrician idea of the BBC, that it was there to educate the masses, that sort of went out, the new idea sort of came in with the idea of sort of comprehensive education, I suppose, that,
came in later, actually. I mean, I think in the sort of golden years of Shirley Williams and also the years of the Black Papers on education, at that time the BBC still was Reithian to a large extent. It's much more recently that telly has turned round in that direction. It started to happen in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, it's not that old.
Although there's been a peculiar upturn with these sort of digital stations like BBC Four and so forth.
Which is great.
Are marvellous and bringing back the sort of qualities that we used to get when Channel 4 first started.
BBC Four, I mean, especially, I mean, now under Janice Hadlow and previously under Rowley Keating, I mean, they are doing exactly what Channel 4 was meant to do and patently neglects to do, but neglects to do in such a way that it is not getting good ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And good ratings obviously affect, you know, advertising. So, it'll, you know, until they go back to doing that stuff, I mean, it's all very well appealing to youth, but youth doesn't have any money.
I was curious, as you mentioned a few sort of great documentary makers earlier, and I was curious as to whether you saw your own work in a tradition as such, because one of the things that I think is interesting about your work is it kind of crosses between genres. It's not just an architecture program as such, and it does cross over into politics and into various sort of philosophical ideas as well. Did you see any sort of antecedents to that?
Well, I can see antecedents, but you don't see antecedents till after you've started doing the stuff, I think. I mean, I think you set out thinking, I want to do programmes like Fife Robertson, or... Mm-hmm. Actually, no one who's listening to this is going to remember Fife Robertson.
I remember Robertson.
Yes, I know, but... I think if you set out thinking... Unless you do that very deliberate thing, which certain artists in all sorts of, you know, people... Sort of, you know, like Picasso said, you know, copy anyone but never copy yourself.
Mm.
And so he would think to himself, right, I'm going to do this like Munch would do it. And obviously he doesn't end up doing it like Munch. He doesn't end up doing it like Picasso, but it's a way in. And, you know, I mean, that is one way of proceeding. It's not a way... But, I mean... I can see who my antecedent... I mean, Ian Nairn, obviously,
mm-hmm.
Who I was very keen on, and both as a writer and as someone who made programmes. I was also, you know, there's also part of me that wanted to be Marty Feldman. There's part of me that wanted to be Benny Hill.
Did that side come out in the surrealism documentary?
I think it comes out in an awful lot.
There's a lot of surrealism.
I think Marty Feldman is my absolutely favourite person ever on TV. I much preferred him on TV to when he went and became a, you know, sort of someone who co-starred with Gene Wilder.
Mm.
There's a lot of other stuff on TV which I was always very interested in. There's a lot of stuff in prose writing that I was very interested in. And the very earliest stuff I did on TV, I thought, well, you have to do it like this and you have to do it within a format. And then suddenly occurred to me that no one was saying you couldn't do it otherwise. And so I did it and have very seldom been... told not to do.
It's interesting because I suspect your programmes probably do hit nerves at people who just chance across it. I've been recently reading Jonathan Coe's book about B.S. Johnson, and he describes sort of seeing this when he was about 14. Some programme, I think it's called something like Fat Man on the Beach or something.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary sounding programme. And he said he was about 14. It absolutely fascinated him. And his mum and dad were sort of grumbling around going, what on earth is this rubbish, you know? And I think your programmes possibly work in that sort of way. If you chance on it, it's not easy to get an immediate handle on what you're doing. And it becomes more fascinating because of that.
B.S. Johnson used to write hockey reports for The Observer. not many people know that.
It's an extraordinary fact.
I think at the time when he was making those programmes, I mean, he didn't make that money, many. I mean, nor did he make any money. And he topped himself, which I don't intend to do.
I'd be relieved to hear that.
I won't do it in the studio anyway. it'd be very messy. And the quality carpet, my God. I think at that time, and certainly when I first did stuff for the BBC, I mean, the first series I ever did was for Channel 4, and then I... my first BBC series was in 1989, and at that point there wasn't this thing of there weren't bullet points and all of that business of what, you know, where does it fit in. Indeed, I was actually in a department at Elstree called History and Quizzes for that first series, which was ridiculous. They didn't make any history and they didn't make any quizzes, but that's what it's called. They had to call it something. But subsequently, there has been this pressure for things to be formulaic, which is a terrible mistake, because anything that's any good effectively does create its own kind,
yeah,
its own genre.
Out,
I mean,
different areas of constantly.
And, you know, it's all this sort of classification, which has partly come about because so much of TV is populated by people who sort of started in journalism and in publishing and so on, in that sort of time-out world where everything, there's a kind of taxonomy for everything. This is post-punk, pre-romantic, something, something, something. And everything has got a kind of, you know, it has to fit. It's as if you're classifying birds' eggs or something.
Very familiar. I'm sure it'll be familiar to a lot of listeners on Resonance FM that if you were interested in improvised music, there was never a space for it. Sometimes it would be in rock and pop. Sometimes it would be in jazz. Nobody quite knew where to put it. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
It's a British disease, actually, this.
It's categorisation.
Of categorisation, yes. Yeah.
It's a very male thing as well, isn't it, unfortunately?
I think there is
an element of the Greiser about it.
Well, it's probably time for us to play a song. There's a bit of a preamble before this record comes on, but we'll hear it because it is quite amusing. This is Crystal and Robin Bernard, and it's called The Monkey Song.
But right now, by the miracle of recording, we're going to go to a recent Sunday morning service in the which two precious little girls were singing. Their names, Robin and Crystal Bernard. Reverend Mrs. Jerry Bernard are the parents. Jerry is accompanying Robin and Crystal as they sing, but this is a happy song, a song that they sang in the Sunday morning service that was televised nationwide. We had so many requests for them to do it again that that's exactly what they did. The Monkey Song. It's their answer to the ridiculous theory of evolution. So right now, by the miracle of recording, Robin and Crystal Bernard singing a song that probably you haven't heard before, but I'm sure after you hear it this time, you'll want to be hearing it again. I don't know of any better way than just to call it what it is. It's the Monkey Song, and it's about the monkey theory, the ridiculous theory of evolution that refutes the Bible account of creation. Robin and Crystal Bernard.
I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. It seems so unbelievable, and yet they're saying it's true. Teaching us about it in school now, that humans were monkeys once too. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. Although it's so ridiculous, they're teaching us now that it's true. The teachers that came from a monkey would be better off in the zoo. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. It seems so much more believable, and surely, surely it's true. That God made man in his image, no monkey story will do. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. This monkey business had to go, because it just isn't true. It's such a disgrace to the monkey, a disgrace to the human race too. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. Mine didn't swing from a tree. Mine didn't swing from a tree.
Well, that was Crystal and Robin Bernard, The Monkey Song, and thanks to the miracle of broadcasting, you're back with Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, and we're talking to Jonathan Meads.
Jonathan, I came across a quote where apparently you've described yourself at some point as the cardinal of atheism. I'd be curious to know where on earth that came from.
No, I think it was a joke with Keith Porteous Wood, who runs the National Secular Society. And I think we started addressing ourselves each other as Pope and Cardinal, and it leaked.
But obviously, your atheism is very important to you. Have you always been an atheist? Did you grow up in an atheist household, or did you
I grew up in a household. My parents were completely indifferent to religion. I wouldn't say they were atheists, but they were agnostic and sceptical.
Mm-hmm.
Although my mother taught in a Church of England primary school, there was no obligation in those days for her to express any sort of faith or solidarity with that particular denomination. I mean, I went to the cathedral school in Salisbury, where I was actually very happy, save that Salisbury is one of those places where the church has an extraordinary amount of temporal power. It owns a lot of land, it owns lots of houses. The society of that town was in those days very much around the cathedral and so on. And the snobbism of the clergy, these are desiccated old men, towards my parents was something I didn't like.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, you could just tell. I mean, you can tell when people think your parents aren't quite up to aren't up to their standard, etc. It wasn't really. I didn't like that, but it wasn't really that. I mean, I think to an extent, some people had a kind of credulous gene, and other people lack the gene for credulous or credulity, and I just don't have it. I mean, you can see that people do because they move from one denomination to another. You know, mm-hmm. one week they're Catholic, then they lose their Catholicism, and they find Islam, and then they find
New Age.
They go around sampling, and this is a pretty common phenomenon. Whereas I think people who are outside it are outside it. And I'm not contemptuous of people who believe one delusion or another, religions are institutionalized superstitions. I mean, some are more successful than others. God is basically, as I've written somewhere, he's the fairy at the end of the garden who succeeded in a kind of Darwinian way. You know, God made
it.
Nice way
of looking at it. Yeah.
Prophet Muhammad, as we now have to call him. I mean, why can't he just be called Muhammad? He made it too. Siddhartha made it. A lot of these things don't make it. I mean, I don't think anyone believes in Thor any longer. Or
Zeus or Anansi or any of those fellows.
I mean, they're kind of names that you give to washing powders. See, I mean, you can have a washing powder called Muhammad and he cleans your soul for you.
One day.
I do think it comes down to some basic predisposition to whether you are capable of not believing or give in to belief.
It's interesting that you went to a cathedral school with a beautiful cathedral. Did that sort of awaken your interest in architecture?
Yeah,
you
very
there?
Much.
And did it ever bother you that the building was this
I think buildings, whether they be secular buildings or great churches like Salisbury Cathedral or St. Paul's or things, they're St. Paul's, quite evidently, I mean, it's Wren's epitaph, isn't it? It's, if you want a monument, if you want to look around you, it's a monument to a man, and it's a monument to the men who built it. And the churches are monuments to humankind and humankind's ingenuity, and so are secular buildings. They're nothing to do with God or what. And buildings in general, I don't think I don't think it matters what they were for originally, if they're any good aesthetically. I mean, they are buildings are lumps of sculpture in a townscape or a landscape. Their function is kind of irrelevant and does become irrelevant because, I mean, Salisbury Cathedral, I think, would be great for pole dancing. Because you've got
well,
those columns.
Well, it's interesting. We were talking earlier about the cathedral in before the programme started, I ought to mention, about the cathedral in Vilnius, which I think was used as a tractor repair shop.
Yeah, it was used as all sorts of things, yeah.
Would that bother you especially?
Well, if...
If Salisbury Cathedral was used as a tractor repair shop.
Well, I think if the mechanics, if the grease monkeys descended from not from monkeys but just the gods grease monkeys, if they were to to damage the works of art in there, yes, I think it would be annoying. But otherwise, yeah, why not have tractors in there? I actually once went into Lincoln Cathedral at Harvest Festival. The first thing you saw was a combine harvester, which was wonderful. I mean, the incongruity of this big red combine harvester in Lincoln, which again is a fantastic building. I think a lot of clergy rather think this too. I mean, they I don't think they believe any of this drivel. Well, some of them do, but an awful lot don't. They're just kind of, they're quite worldly.
It's interesting because, sorry, Neil, it actually connects slightly with something we were talking to one of our previous guests, David Aronovich, about, and he was saying, well, you know, we're all sort of having a bit of a laugh and a bit of a go at religion, but he said, actually, you know, you have to remember that if you look at the groups that are... doing a lot of work for asylum seekers in inner London cities, you'll often find it's the church groups that are doing that, which is an interesting point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the church is a kind of social welfare organisation. I think it's fine, but it's what Attlee said, you know, the ethics, yes, the mumbo-jumbo, no.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting the point you've just raised about, you know, I don't know whether these people even believe in this in this stuff. I think it's something we can only really say, you know, given, you know, having the luxury of the Church of England, basically, because I can't really imagine... Well, you certainly wouldn't get away with that in Syria or something, but I don't think you'd get away with that in Italy, Syria.
But, in Syria, certainly wouldn't. In Italy, of course, yeah, in Italy, I think you would.
Well, I mean, it's just that the Church of England strikes me as being as close as a religion can get to being basically atheist anyway.
Well, it is self-secularising and has been, I think, since... Obviously, at certain points, I mean, you know, the Oxford movement and ecclesiologists and so on, 1820s, 30s and 40s, they made the Church very, very potent again. They made it after the kind of the Enlightenment, which was... You know, I mean, David Hume, I mean, what did he say? Religion is sick men's dreams. Mm-hmm. Quite right. But the reaction to the Enlightenment was very powerful and obviously architecturally manifest in thousands of churches built everywhere in a medieval style and the attempt to render secular buildings like railway stations as churches, and to turn them
indeed.
Into, you know, make them holy places and shops and houses and so on. So the Church of England has, at certain points, been very, very potent. It's probably only in the last, 70, 80 years that it's become increasingly, you know, it's sort of religion light. I mean, it's not something you really, you can believe in it, but it doesn't actually affect your life. And this is what I think makes it very difficult for us to understand the mindset of people who are effectively brainwashed by religion, which is what Islam does. I mean, my closest Islamic friend ever, never went near a mosque and drank himself to death. You know, he was never seen without a drink in his hand apart from when he was rolling a joint.
So, can I ask... I don't know if there's even really an answer to this question, but how has being an atheist actually informed your work as a filmmaker and a writer?
I don't understand... The only way I can put it is I don't understand how I could write if I had a belief in something or other. I think it would be so inhibiting, and I don't rarely get writers... who claim to have faith. I mean, one can see in a writer like Anthony Burgess, I mean, his former faith contaminates or infects his work to a very large extent. And one can see that in someone like Graham Greene. You know, Betjeman is held up as some kind of Anglican. Betjeman didn't believe in anything. He quite liked, you know, hymns and smells and bells, but he didn't actually believe any of it. And I think this, I think the same goes for you know, Sterne, you know, was a clergyman, but an 18th century clergyman didn't have to believe in anything. It was just like having a sinecure. I think anyone who seriously believes in theism can only write what is effectively propaganda, because you're certainly working to someone else's system.
Mm-hmm.
You can only really write, I suspect, if you are free of any kind of ism. I mean, you know, you have to make up your own ism.
So what do you think about somebody like C.S. Lewis, then, who is, again, also often sort of talked about as being a sort of Anglican writer?
I found him unreadable as a child, and I've never broached him since.
Well, I have to admit, I never actually read any of his books as a child, but went to see The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe at the cinema, having sort of been primed for it by all these articles in the newspaper saying, it was terrible, it's all Christian propaganda. And I could, if I hadn't known that, I could quite easily have sat through the entire thing and come out and not noticed, quite frankly.
Really? It was, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just didn't like it at the age of 11 or 12 when I was incited to read it by someone at school, certainly not by my parents. And I didn't get on with it. And I remember actually my parents rather disapproved of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. And I didn't ask, but I remember they're a bit sniffy about it.
My parents did approve it, but I had a religious upbringing, and I actually read some of his science fiction as well, which is the most dreary, bad sci-fi I've ever read. So it helped put me off, I think, which was probably a useful thing.
Well, there's okay. We want to talk about the Joe Building, the Stanley Memorial Lecture, which is your which is the television program that you've got coming up in the next few weeks. But to get into that, basically, there's another point about atheism, that something that always annoys me and has annoyed me for years, is there's a criticism of atheism that says basically that it inevitably led to the totalitarianism in the mid 20th century and the Nazis and Stalinists and communism, etc. And this annoys me intently, because, you know, my atheism is informed by the ideas of the Enlightenment and about liberal democracy, and these are ideas that were completely anathema to Hitler and Stalin, for instance. And I understand that the idea behind the programme is that you're talking about this idea that it's particularly about Stalin and the architecture of the Stalinist regime. And there's this idea that Stalin murdered God.
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, Russia was an extremely superstitious country. And Stalin saw religion as a potential opponent,
mm-hmm.
as something which might foment a kind of independence of mind, or rather, it might not be independent, but it was different from what he wanted people to believe, and so the church was effectively destroyed. It was done. But the same process happened with the Nazis. I mean, Himmler created a new kind of religion, with the mm-hmm. SS having kind of naming ceremonies and so on, and a huge amount of paganism, you know, solstice rubbish and so on, as an alternative to Christianity. And so it drew on paganism. It didn't call itself paganism. And this would be the Nazi religion. And Stalin did the same, say that he didn't try and replace the various churches in Russia with anything but himself. I mean, he wanted to be God.
Mm-hmm.
And he was bloody good at it. He had you know, there's Stalin the son and Lenin the father. As I was saying, you know, before, I think one of the ideas was that if you had Lenin there as the father, you could excuse yourself by saying, I am doing God's bidding. Mm-hmm. I am doing Vladimir Ilyich's bidding. And, yeah, it's gone wrong, but it's not. I'm not the one to blame.
I'm just following the program.
Yeah. And, of course, Stalin was also... this is evident in his buildings and in his taste, in sort of aesthetic taste in general. There was something very oriental about him. Lenin referred to him as an Asian, and there is something of the sort of Asian potentate from the steppes,
mm-hmm.
and that quality of the kind of warlord who is more than just a man. He is a kind of god eating yak butter.
Where was Stalin not from? Uzbekistan or one of those?
He was from Georgia.
Georgia,
yeah.
So it's not quite the same.
Ossetia.
Uh-huh.
And that Mandelstam referred to him as an Ossetian, which he most certainly didn't like. I mean, it's one of the reasons that Mandelstam died. You know, be careful.
One of many reasons.
Well, probably. One of many reasons, but I mean that was that particular.
He wasn't a man
verse.
So upset.
No, I mean he was very easily upset. He's very, very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Terribly sensitive.
So talk to us about the about some of the buildings then that you talk about in the program.
Well, one of the things I made a program 11 years ago called Jerry Building,
sure.
about Hitlerian architecture, or the architecture of that period in Germany. I think it's wrong to call it Hitlerian.
Is Speer then, presumably?
Well, there's very
about.
Little about Speer in it, because I mean that is well known. I was much more interested in the folkish stuff, and in the kind of the everyday stuff of Nazism, because Speer didn't actually build that much. He just did the kind of grand things.
Sure. Well, obviously his vision for Berlin never got completed.
Whereas Stalin, you know, the Third Reich lasted for 12 years and whatever it was, 3 months. During 6 of those years they were at war. Whereas Stalin was in power for 25 years almost, and had a chance to build an awful lot more and to realise sort of grand projects, and did so. And they are, whereas the architecture of Nazism has some kinship with architecture in the rest of Europe at that time, the architecture of the Soviet Union from the early 30s through till Stalin's death in 53 is largely independent of Europe and of the rest of Asia. It takes a surprising amount from America, from kind of skyscrapers you might get in Tulsa or Lincoln, Nebraska or somewhere.
Sure.
It's fantastically kitsch. It does have this quality that we were talking about earlier of accessibility. I mean, it is very figurative, very literal, meant to be understood by all the people. The architecture in the very first years of the revolution, constructivism, which was Russia's take on international modernism, was completely suppressed by Stalin because it was only comprehensible to the educated, to architects, to people who are interested in design. Stalin wanted to create a kind of architecture which was understandable to 30% of the population in 1935 in Russia couldn't read.
Sure.
And he wanted an architecture which people right down at the bottom of the sort of intellectual pile could understand.
Well, presumably a lot of people at the top of the intellectual pile had also been wiped out as well.
Yeah. There's a huge fear of intellect. There is a huge fear of beauty. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, have a look at Mrs. Khrushchev. So it was big, it was bright, it was figurative, it was expressive, and its message was, you know, this is power written in stone. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was doing these vast, he's behaving like a force of nature, you know, creating huge inland seas with slave labor, of mm-hmm. course. And they would have statuary hundreds of feet high of heroic laborers and heroic commissars and heroic Stalins and heroic Lenins. And it was like he was changing the geology of the country, and he tried to change the climate. They used cloud seeding to affect clear skies on the days of great parades, and they sold ice cream in winter to try and convince people that the climate was hotter than it was.
It wasn't just saying that it was big and powerful, but it was also saying it was going to be there forever.
And saying it was going to be there forever, and much better than it was. And it was spin of a sort of gyroscopic nature beyond anything that Alistair Campbell could have ever dreamt of. Or Goebbels, for that matter.
So much better in terms of aesthetically, or was it just very built badly as well? What these things have
been. It's well built kitsch. It's mm-hmm. very solid kitsch, but it does have a sort of. I mean, it is without precedent in a way, but you can see that there is something kind of oriental about it, and the kind of brightness and sort of maximalism of it, you know, the idea that of elegance through being expressed in a sort of Vanbrugh-ish way by a completely blank wall with mm-hmm. just a few inflections, be totally lost on these people. Mm. Everything has got to be encrusted and decorated and busy. Nothing can be left, because the more you have, the richer you are, the more powerful you are, and it's very simple stuff.
So in that sense, it was very similar to the Catholic Rome, St. Peter's.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like yeah, especially to the Catholic Baroque. I mean, the stuff of the Counter-Reformation. I mean, and the Baroque coincided. I mean, whether the Counter-Reformation actually created the Baroque. You know, people go on arguing about it forever. I mean, it's an art historical point, but they did coincide, and the Catholic Church did use the Baroque, and because it showed how mighty it was, by showing how wealthy it was, and that is what the Soviets did.
Well, it's funny you raise that, because this, when you were talking about these edifices, you know. So I could imagine them people being terrified from miles away seeing these huge buildings. It reminds me of nothing more than what the cathedrals were like, what these cathedrals would have been. Like we see a cathedral now and it's obviously, you know, it's magnificent, but we forget what it would have been like in medieval times when it was this huge building surrounded by little, you know, thatched cottages basically. And you get that sort of idea when you go to somewhere like, I don't know, Mont-Saint-Michel or Chartres or something, or even Ely or something, where you can see the cathedral from everywhere, like miles and miles away. And I can imagine that's what these, you know, poor sort of peasants in Russia must have felt when they gazed up upon these things.
They would have been like sort of medieval peasants here. Mm-hmm. And these places, the palaces that Stalin built, were the largest things that they would ever see in their life. Just as sort of, you know, if you live in a hovel, and people in those days, of course, much shorter than they were. They're often only 9 inches tall, people in those days. And they would walk into Salisbury Cathedral and they think, my God, you know, the sheer height of it. No, obviously they were smaller. And so size was very, very important. I mean, you know, sheer dimensions are a very crucial thing in the architecture of of tyrannies.
Well, it reminds me as well, as I don't know if you saw it, there was recently a sort of coffee table book published called The Interior Design of the Dictators or something.
Oh, yeah,
did
yeah,
you
see that? York thing, yeah.
And, yeah, that's very much similar, isn't it? Even today, these dictators around the world, be it Saddam Hussein or...
Well, Ceausescu, only, lovely guy, great taste. Yeah, the only one of the dictators who exercised sort of aesthetic control and had any taste was Mussolini. And a lot of that architecture is actually quite good, and the new towns that he built on reclaimed land south of Rome, Sabaudia and Latina, are really quite interesting.
Yeah, I've seen a place in Sardinia that I can't remember what it was called, but there's a little place in Sardinia that was built by Mussolini, a little tiny little sort of new town, and that was, yeah, it was pretty, very impressive in its scale and its, you know,
and
dimensions.
And AUR, you know, on the side of Rome where the exhibition was going to be, had the war not intervened, you know, in the years of international exhibitions, it was going to be in Rome in 1940. And it's used in endless adverts. It's quite impressive, and you can dissociate it from what it was made for. But as I say, you can dissociate all of these things, save that with Stalin's stuff, it's just kind of never going to come round somehow.
I'm just wondering if you know, when you're confronted by the sort of the monumentally kitsch, whether you're still impressed or whether you just sort of go, well, it's, you know, I can see what it's trying to do. Because, I mean, sometimes I'm... For example, I mean, it's not a totalitarian book at all, but it's Gaudi's Cathedral in Barcelona. I mean, that to me is monumental kitsch.
It's funny,
hugely, you know, it does affect you. It is just so powerful.
When I was sort of 20, I thought Gaudi was the absolute works. Now I really don't. I mean, it just seems so whimsical. And kind of it's tweeness on a sort of giant scale.
It's this sort of sci-fi quality that when the cathedral's finished, it's got that huge cross at the top of it, which you can walk inside and view the city from.
Yeah,
extraordinary.
We're about running out of time, unfortunately. Okay. It's been really great. So, Jonathan, thanks very much for taking the trouble to join us this afternoon on Little Atoms.
Thank you.
And the programme will be coming up in April, we're hoping.
I believe so.
And the title is?
Joe Building, the Stalin Memorial Lecture.
And it'll be on BBC Two, so look out for that. You can find our website on www.littleatoms.com, and you can download previous interviews and this one, hopefully early next week.
Well, that should be the case. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time, where we'll be talking to AC Grayling about bombing.
Thanks to Chris Weaver for engineering today.
And thanks for listening.